The stories of the Old Testament have such a powerful way of expressing pictures and insights and truths that, can help us learn so much about how God deals with us and how we need to trust Him. And you'll remember that in the last chapter, we dealt with Jacob on his way back to his homeland, told by the Lord to go back after living for 20 years with Laban, his uncle turned father-in-law, and all the things that went along with that trip. And we saw how the Lord met Jacob along the way and actually wrestled with him. And how we saw in that last week how the Lord wants to conquer us. And how the Lord truly conquered Jacob on that trip home. And it began a whole new process of how Jacob is going to deal with life. How he's going to see God and so forth. Doesn't mean that he's going to be an obedient man in any way, shape, or form, in any sort of a perfect sense. But we are going to see a changed man. We're going to see an altered man from the standpoint of just how he now sees life. We're in the 33rd chapter. We dealt with that whole issue of God meeting Jacob. Now it's time for Jacob to meet Esau. And it says in verse 1 that Jacob looked up and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. And it says that he himself went on ahead, and he bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. I want to have you stop there for just a moment. I've heard the question posed, why would Esau be coming to meet Jacob with 400 men? Well, there's a chance that he wasn't. That he wasn't coming to meet Jacob with 400 men. There's a chance that Esau was just moving from one place to the next and happened to have 400 men with him. There's an assumption that goes along with this story that when Jacob sent messengers ahead to tell Esau, your brother's coming, that Esau responded by amassing this group of 400 men and going out to meet his brother, but we don't actually know that at all. The fact of the matter is, Esau could have already been en route to somewhere with 400 men, and Jacob's servants, messengers, if you will, came across Esau, introduced themselves, let them know that Jacob was on his way, and then turned and went back to Jacob and said, by the way, we passed along your message and he's coming this way with 400 men. The assumption on Jacob's part was that Esau was coming to do what he had said he would do 20 years earlier, and that was kill his brother for stealing his birthright and taking the family blessing. But we're going to find here that no such thing is going to happen. Isn't that interesting, too, that our fears are always so much more worse than what actually often happens. And as Jacob prepares now to meet Esau, he puts his children, his families, literally in the order of importance, those that are most important in the back to him in a heart sense. Good, bad, right, or wrong, that's what he did. On another good note, Jacob himself went ahead of them all. And then it says, bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. And Jacob, of course, had already sent over all these gifts to show Esau that he wasn't looking to take anything in any sort of a material sense from his brother. And now, why bow down to the ground 7 times? Well, was that common? Well, not entirely. It was done, but wasn't entirely common. It was, however, a statement to show that Jacob was, in a sense, saying to his brother, I have no desire to have any kind of a social role over you. I have no desire to come and rule over you. So once again, remember we talked last week, all of the gifts that he sent before him were to say to his brother, I don't want what you have, I have plenty. And now he bows down to the ground seven times in order to say to his brother, before even a word is spoken, I am not here to rule over you. In fact, you are the Lord of this area, and I'm going to treat you as such, and I'm going to honor you as such. And he does this as a powerful act of humility. And I want you to know, and of course, Jacob has no idea at this point how Esau is going to respond. Verse 4 tells us, but Esau ran to meet Jacob, just ran over to him and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Do you know what that's like when you have had something in your mind and it has been perhaps one of the most fearful, troublesome thoughts that you've been entertaining, and then you come to the actual point of confronting that thing and it turns out to be the exact opposite of what you feared. And there is this relief that can only probably be expressed in a rush of tears. And there's this response that now Jacob has regarding his brother, and Esau has just because he misses his brother Jacob. Apparently, 20 years has had a pretty powerful impact on both of these men. And Esau is no longer resenting his brother. Probably came to terms with the fact that Jacob was the one. He was the one God had chosen all along. Either that or he was just so amply blessed that he didn't care anymore. But one way or another, he got over it. And he comes now and he just throws his arms around his brother and kisses him. And the two men are weeping aloud as they're embracing one another. And finally, after this very emotional meeting, finally Esau is the first one to speak. In verse 5, it says that Esau looked up and he saw the women and the children, and he wants to know if these people are related to his brother. He says, who are these that are with you? And Jacob responds by saying, these are the children God has graciously given your servant. Do you hear the difference in attitude in Jacob's heart, in Jacob's even in his response? I mean, after wrestling all night with God, you start to have a whole different perspective, you know, about life. And he's now giving credit where credit is due. These are the children that God has graciously given me. And then the maidservants and their children approached, and each in their turn, they bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. And last of all, Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. And after they go through all the pleasantries of meeting family and so forth, then Esau turns to his brother once again and he says, okay, so what is the meaning of all these droves that I met? Now, Esau really already knew the answer to that question because Jacob had prepared his brother to know what they were all about. He told the servants who were with those gifts that he had sent ahead, told them exactly what to tell his brother. But Esau wasn't really sure what to think about all this. And so he's asking now for, you know, some more clarification on this. What do you mean by all these droves that I met along the way? All these things. And Jacob immediately responds by saying, it was to find favor in your eyes, my Lord. But Esau said, listen, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. No, please, said Jacob, if I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God now that you've received me favorably. There's an interesting sort of a double twist along with that. Not only is Jacob talking on a true human sense of just how wonderful it is now to see his brother and to realize that his brother has received him in the way that he probably didn't even dream that he might. But also he makes this statement how seeing his brother's face is like seeing the face of God. Just this, the night before, he saw the face of God. He wrestled with God, and he even said, after the Lord left him there, he said, I have seen the face of God, and I have lived to tell about it. And so he now is connecting the dots, if you will, between this gracious favor that God has given him with his brother and the wrestling match that happened the night before. And in each case, he says, it's like seeing the face of God. And what a wonderful thing. He says, so he says in verse 11, please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me and I have all I need. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. And that is a... Esau did a good thing here. It would have been a huge insult for Esau to continue to resist and reject the gifts that Jacob had sent ahead. And it was a cultural sort of a thing that really kind of demanded that Esau receive gifts. But you know, that's a humbling thing, isn't it? It's a humbling thing to take things from people, you know. And I never realized how humbling it was until after I'd started walking with the Lord. And I've told some of you this story before, so you've heard it before. So this is take two or three, whatever, however long you've been here. But you know, when I first started really kind of serving the Lord, walking with the Lord, and I was raised up at the church that I was attending in Montana, they sent me out to do some Bible studies, and there was a little community about 60 miles away from where we were living in Great Falls, Montana, and this little tiny town, but these people had requested people to come out and do a Bible study, so I was going out and doing a Bible study. Well, one particular, and I forget what day of the week I was even going out there, but they sent the oldest pastor on staff with me to kind of go along with me, and I'm sure I needed coaching pretty badly. So he came along and, you know, encouraged me on the ride there. And while we were there, he listened patiently while I taught the passage. And at the very end of the Bible study, one of the men who was in whose home we were meeting, not in a big way, but just kind of came over to me. And he put his hand out toward me, and I noticed he had a kind of a wadded up roll of dollar bills. And I don't remember whether they're dollars or fives or what they were, but it wasn't much. But he just stuck his hand out with this money. Well, I was instantly taken aback because I had absolutely no expectation. I mean, I loved teaching God's word, and even though most of the people in the room were older than me, and I'm sure I did a horrible job, you know, they were very gracious and wanted to give me this money, and I was like, no. I don't want it. And he said, no, this is, we took a little offering and this is what we want you to have. And I said, listen, I didn't. And the older pastor, wiser pastor, is next to me listening to all this going on. And he just leans over to me very gently and says, take it. Okay. But, you know, I didn't want anybody to see me take it because I was embarrassed. It's kind of humiliating or humbling. I don't know if I was humiliated, but I was definitely humbled. So anyway, I put it in my pocket, and of course, on the way home, I got a little mini sermon for about an hour, you know, from this older, wiser pastor who began to kind of just share with me what it is to humble yourself and receive the gifts of God as they come through the hands of men. And it was a lesson that was a very difficult one to learn, but and I hope I've learned it. But it's always challenging. What I came to understand later was the response that I had to resist that gift was pride. And pride is seated in the flesh of man. And to receive those gifts, to be blessed by that, and to say, thank you, Jesus, was a good thing, you know? And it didn't necessarily, I wasn't making a statement about anything or whatever. It was just receiving what the Lord had and how He wanted to bless. And I began to understand over a period of time what grace is, you know? Because grace is God's blessing that we don't deserve. And do you know, brothers and sisters in Christ, that He's looking for people who know how to receive, who are humble enough to receive? Yet we so often, our pride kind of rises up, you know, and we don't want to, you know, like, Or we don't feel like we're worthy. You know, I mean, it's so often people will say, I just don't feel I'm worthy of God's love. My first response is, I'm really glad you feel that way. Because you never will be. You never will be worthy of God's love. If you get to the point where you feel you're worthy of God's love, you're probably self-deluded. You know? You've probably come to a place of thinking, you're all that and a bag of chips, or I don't know what else, however you want to explain it. You know, and then you're like self-deluded and weird and nobody wants to be around you because you think you're hot stuff. You know? But when we recognize that apart from God and apart from what Christ has done for us on the cross, we are nothing. And we deserve nothing. Nothing of the goodness of God. Nothing of the favor of God. Now we're in a place to begin to receive the greatest of the gifts that He has for us. Because do you know that He wants to give them by grace? Oh, but God, I don't deserve that. I know. You think I was given this because you're good? You think I was given this because I was impressed with you? I'm giving you this because I love you. And I'm looking for people who understand grace. What is the opposite of grace? Legalism. If you have a legalistic relationship with God, then you're always going to be doing to get. Right? And you can always tell a legalistic person. Because when something bad happens in their life, the first thing they say is, what did I do to deserve this? You see, that's legalism. They believe that, you know, you get what you deserve. Can I give you a little secret about the kingdom of God? We don't get what we deserve. And that's a good thing. You know? In fact, it's a really good thing. Because if I got only what I deserved, I would never get around to getting anything. I receive God's love, God's favor, God's blessings because of His grace. Because of His grace. And we must learn, Christians, to receive. We must learn to receive God's grace, which is a free gift. A free expression of His favor that comes not because we have merited that favor, but because God is just a gracious, loving God. And so to accept is to say, you know what? And you know what? Just tell God. As you're receiving the blessings that come your way, just say, you know what, Lord? I don't deserve any of this. Not a bit, but thank you. And just keep your arms open. You know? I'm just keeping my arms open. Because you know what? I know I still don't deserve anything, but I'm going to receive what you're giving me because you're a God of grace and you delight to pour out blessings on your children. It delights you to show mercy. It delights you to extend grace to your children. You know? And it, you know what's really amazing? And I've shared this with you guys before, or I've talked about this before, but it seems to me that after some of the most grievous mistakes that I've made in my life, I have received some of the most abundant blessings. Now try to figure that one out. That can't be explained except for grace. You know? It just can't. Because, you know, in people sometimes they'll read things in the Bible. Like, we've talked about it before. We talked about, you know, Abraham. He goes, he lies about his wife. You know? When they go to Egypt. And then his son Isaac goes and does the same thing. They go to a pagan city and he lies about his wife, about his relationship to her. And both of the men walk away from those situations with blessings. And people look at that and they go, what's up with that? Is God blessing deception? Of course not. It's God's grace. We need to learn to recognize it. It's God's grace. He loves you even though you're a knucklehead. He loves you even though you make mistakes. He loves you and He wants to bless you even though you're a mess up. Just get used to it, you know? And thank Him for His blessing and receive His blessing. Thank you, Lord. Thank you. I know I don't deserve this, but thank you. And I think saying thank you is a good thing to do, don't you? I mean, it just shows that appreciation. Remember when Jesus healed those 10 lepers? Healed them all. But only one came back to say thank you. Only one came back and fell at His feet. And Jesus even responded and acknowledged that this man was doing good, but He said, but where are the other nine? You know? They didn't deserve anything either, but they all got the same thing, which was healing. And yet, where are they now? Come and just say thank you. God, I didn't deserve any of that, but thank you so much. So, verse 12 says that Esau then says, okay, great, I'll take what you brought me. Fine. Then let us be on our way. I'll accompany you. But Jacob said to him, listen, my Lord knows that the children are tender and that I must care for the ewes and the cows that are nursing their young. If they're driven hard, just one day all the animals will die. So let my Lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the droves before me and that of the children until I come to my Lord in Seir, which is where Esau basically lived. And, you know, Jacob was bringing up a legitimate issue. Esau and his 400 men, who were obviously soldier-type individuals, they could move along pretty rapidly. The children, the animals, they couldn't go nearly as fast. So Esau says to him, well, in that case, you know, let me just leave some of my men with you. In other words, to kind of, you know, help out. We can help move things along. But why do that, Jacob asked. Let me just find favor in the eyes of my Lord. And so that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. And it sounds like Jacob kind of leads him on to say, you know, listen, I'll meet you there. But he didn't necessarily promise he was going to come right away. It says, Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. In fact, that's why the place is called Succoth, because Succoth means shelter. And by the way, Succoth is not in the promised land, or what we would refer to as the promised land proper. He's not yet in the land of Canaan, if you will. He's close, but he's not quite there. But he's stopping at a place where they can rest. And it says that he puts up some, probably when it says he made shelters for his livestock, it was probably some quick, shabby sort of just poles and branches and so forth, just some shade and so forth. And they're going to stay there for a little while. I don't know, you know, it doesn't actually say how long, probably longer than he thought. But eventually he's going to begin moving again. He does that then in verse 18. And it says that after Jacob came from Padan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. Now, Shechem was a very prominent city. And what else can I tell you about Shechem? It was essentially in the area of Samaria, or what would be in Samaria later on. And it was still, the place was still overrun with Canaanites. So you've seen in Genesis and some of our previous studies how whenever one of God's people camps closely to a pagan city, usually rotten things happen because the influence of that city makes its way into the family of God. And we're going to see some of that here. But he's actually going to buy some land. It says for 100 pieces of silver. He bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. So this Hamor is kind of a chieftain of the city of Shechem, and he has a son actually named Shechem as well. But it tells us here that that's where Jacob pitched his tent, and he set up an altar and called it El Elohi Israel. And then we get into chapter 34, and this is where the influence of the area begins to take its toll. It says, now Dinah, the daughter Leah had born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the land. I want you to stop there for just a little while. This gives us a little sense of how long Jacob and his family stayed there in the area of Shechem. We can assume that even though he planted his family there, that he went on to the area of Hebron where his father was living to visit Isaac and so forth. But for some reason, his family, they decided to stay there near Shechem. And so there was obviously a number of years. Dinah was one of the last of the kids born. She wouldn't have been terribly old. In fact, the oldest child would have been maybe 12 when they got back into the land. And that was Reuben. So Dinah was probably quite young. So they probably stayed there, maybe 10 years. And she is now maybe an early teenager, is probably a best guess. And, you know, she's growing up in this house full of boys, that had to be a little boring for a young girl from time to time. And it sounds, or it seems as if the narrative is telling us that she is just kind of looking for some connectedness with some women of the land. And so she's making her way to Shechem in order to do that. But of course, this is a dangerous move. Jacob has planted his family next to a pagan city. And these people had all kinds of traditions and practices that were very immoral, very questionable. We're going to see that in just a bit. But letting his daughter go into the city unattended was really a bad move on Jacob's part as a father. He just was not being protective of his daughter in this situation. And so it says that when Shechem, son of Hamor, the Hivite, the ruler of that area, saw her, he took her and violated her. And of course, you know, that means he had sexual relations with her. Now, in a pagan sort of a city, a woman like this, even a young girl, would have been considered free game. I mean, these people had incorporated acts of sex into their pagan rituals and practices. And so this is something that's kind of out in the open. It's being practiced in a very open and lascivious way. And he kind of falls for this girl, and there's no concept of just the sanctity of marriage. Kind of reminds us of the United States of America. And he just basically takes her. And a woman doesn't have a whole lot of ability at this point to have a say in the matter one way or the other. And so it happens the way it happens. But we're told that his intentions were actually somewhat honorable, because in verse 3, we're told that his heart was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. And then we find out in the next verse that he, in fact, wanted to marry her, but he couldn't just do it on his own. And so it says that in verse 4, Shechem said to his father Hamor, "Get me this girl as my wife." And so there were still some traditions that they held to related to marriage, and apparently Shechem could not just marry the girl without permission, you know, from the family. They at least held to some traditions that showed some sense of honor, and so he has to go to his father. He's not even going to go all by himself. He goes to his father. "I want you to go and get this this girl, you know, as my wife." So, you know, there's at least some sense of honor there in that Shechem didn't just violate her and then drop her off on somebody's doorstep, which has we've seen happen in the Bible before too. He at least wants to marry her. He loves her. He's speaking, you know, well to her, tenderly to her, and he's actually taken her into his home, which we get from the context of the passage. Now, verse 5 lets us know that Jacob got word of this whole situation. And we're told that when Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the field with their livestock, and so he kept quiet about it until they came home. Now, apparently, before they actually get into the living area, Shechem's father, Hamor, goes out and actually comes to meet Jacob about this whole affair. And it says that now Jacob's sons had come in from the fields, and as soon as they heard what happened, they were filled with grief and fury because Shechem had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing that should not be done. All right. Well, that is encouraging on one hand, that Jacob had somehow conveyed to his sons the morality and the propriety that you don't do that sort of thing to a young girl, or any girl for that age, to just take her and violate her in that sense. And they believed that it was improper for that to be done. And so they're angry about this. But of course, the Shechemites, they obviously have no issues with this, because it says in verse 8, and you look at this, is kind of interesting, but Hamor said to them, "My son Shechem has his heart set on your daughter, so please give her to him as his wife. Intermarry with us, give us your daughters and take our daughters for yourselves. You can settle among us. The land is open to you. Live in it, trade in it, and acquire property in it. And then Shechem said to Dinah's father and brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and I will give you whatever you ask. Make the price of the bride and the gift I am to bring as great as you like, and I'll pay whatever you ask. Only give me the girl as my wife. Stop there. It's interesting, isn't it? And this tells you a little bit about the morality of the Shechemites. There's no word of apology. There's no word of remorse. There's no word of regret. You know, Hamor doesn't come to Jacob, pull him aside and say, listen, I have to apologize, but let's make this thing right. None of that. So, which it gives you a sense of understanding about what the Shechemites are all about. This is just kind of life. This is a man taking a woman and just having her is just not an uncommon thing. And it apparently isn't something you apologize to her father about, which is kind of blows my mind, you know. And I think that as mad as Dinah's brothers were at the whole insult that had been made to their sister, now they're standing back and listening as this man steps forward and begins to bargain for their sister as if she's a piece of property. As if she's, and they're gonna say it like they mean it here in just a little bit. They think that this is tantamount to treating her like a prostitute, because here they are now talking about buying and selling. They're saying, hey, name your price. We'll take the girl off your hands, sort of a thing, you know. It's enough to make a father's blood boil, you know. And anybody who's ever been a father or father of a daughter or whatever, you know, you gotta wonder how Jacob didn't just grab a sword and start slashing. I mean, on the spot sort of a thing, you know. But anyway, you know, here's this guy saying, hey, you know, just name your price. We'll take Dinah off your hands, sort of a thing. You know, it's very, very insulting. Very rude, obviously. Verse 13 says, because their sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully as they spoke to Shechem and his father Hamor. Now stop here. I just need to interject here that it apparently at this point Jacob himself, the father, leaves the room or leaves the area of the discussion. Could be that he's been so upset about this thing, he just has to leave. But he is not a party to this thing. He's not hearing what his sons are saying deceitfully to these men. And they begin to speak to Hamor and they say, listen, verse 14, we can't give her to you. We can't do such a thing because we just can't give our sister to a man who isn't circumcised. That would be a disgrace to us. So, you know, we'll give our consent to you on one condition only, and that is that you become like us by circumcising all your males. And then we'll give you our daughter and take your daughters for ourselves, and we'll settle among you and become one with you. And if you'll not agree to be circumcised, well, then we're just going to take our sister and go. So that's the proposal. You know, there you go. And it says in verse 18 that their proposal seemed good to Hamor and his son Shechem. Now, you might kind of listen to that and go, goodness gracious, who would agree to such a thing? But it was not, you know, the Jews were not the only cultural people who practiced circumcision. There were others. It became a covenant sign for the Jews that was introduced through Abraham and his sons. But it was not entirely an uncommon thing. And with the prospect of being able to intermarry with these people and therefore basically assume their goods, it was a very alluring sort of a bargain. And so it says their proposal seemed pretty good to Hamor and his son. And so the young man who was the most honored of all his father's household lost no time in doing what they said, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. And so Hamor and his son Shechem went to the gate of their city to speak to their fellow townsmen. Listen, they said, these men are friendly toward us, so let us live in our land, or let them live, rather, in our land and trade in it. The land has plenty of room for them. We can marry their daughters, and they can marry ours. But the men will consent to live with us as one people only on the condition that our males be circumcised as they themselves are. Won't their livestock, their property, and all their other animals become ours? So let us give our consent to them, and they will settle among us. And it says that all the men who went out of the city gate agreed with Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male in the city was circumcised. Wow, that's amazing. You can just crazy. 3 days later, while all of them were still in pain, and obviously Jacob's sons knew just how long to wait, two of Jacob's sons, notice this, although it seems like the whole gaggle of them were involved in the deception, two of them specifically now take up arms. Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and attacked the unsuspecting city, killing every single man, every single male. And they put Hamor and his son Shechem to the sword, and they took Dinah from Shechem's house. That's where we know that she'd been living there. And they left. Isn't that amazing? So they went into the city at the time when they knew that the men would not be able to move, not be able to defend themselves. And they slaughtered them. It was a massacre. It was a massacre. It was a massacre of some of the worst proportions that we actually read about in the Bible. It was a hideous thing. It really was. And the sons of Jacob came upon the dead bodies and looted the city where their sister had been defiled. They seized their flocks and herds and donkeys and everything else of theirs in the city and out in the fields. They carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in the houses. And then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You've brought trouble on me by making me a stench to the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the people living in the land. We are few in number, and if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my household will be destroyed." But they replied, "Should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?" Now, the question that the sons of Jacob are putting to their father is more than just an attempt to throw up a lame excuse for why they did what they did. What they are doing is they are confronting their father in his inaction, his lack of action toward this situation. And what that means is they're basically accusing their dad of doing nothing. When this man, Hamor and his son, came into his house and Jacob knew what had happened to his daughter, he should have done something about it at that time. He should have stood up for what was right at that time. But apparently Jacob was overcome with the grief of the situation and left the room and allowed his sons to carry on some kind of communication with these men, which he shouldn't have trusted them. But and this thing came to what it did because essentially the provocation of the situation became such that because Jacob did not act, his sons were put in a place where they felt like they had to. And being the young, hot-headed men that they were, they slaughtered every man in the entire town. And it's really a sad sort of a situation, but it's also kind of a wake-up call to dads, to be completely honest with you. And the question that they're asking him in verse 31, "Should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?" is essentially a rebuke of Jacob saying, "You stood there and you listened as they bargained for this daughter like a piece of meat, knowing that they had previously violated her without her consent. And you just walked away and you didn't do anything about it. Should our daughter, your daughter, our sister, have been treated that way?" And you know, you'll notice here, Jacob doesn't respond to his sons, and it probably because he had to go out and take a walk and think about it for a while, because he was no doubt under some pretty serious conviction for his lack of action. And you know, there's an important lesson here, I think, just about, you know, dads, just, we got to take action sometimes, and not stupid action, you know, not cruel and unlawful action, but we do need to protect our children. Of course, Jacob, you know, he's looking at this situation, realizing probably at this point, I shouldn't have let her go there in the first place. I shouldn't have let her walk into the city in the first place. What was I thinking? My daughter wanted some female companionship, some girls her own age. I got this house full of boys. There's nobody for her to talk to about those sorts of things. And so what does she do? She naturally makes her way into the city of Shechem and gets into trouble. Why did I let her go alone? Why didn't I have one of her brothers go and accompany her? Why didn't I protect her? And then when they came and confronted me with this horrific thing that was done to her, why didn't I act in some way? It was an important sort of a thing. Now, the culpability of Jacob as a father, of course, doesn't remove in any way the responsibility of these two sons, Simeon and Levi. And do you know that many years from this point, when Jacob is about to pass from this life, he's going to speak a word prophetically over all of his boys. And Simeon and Levi are going to be just passed over because of what they've done. And because he's speaking prophetically, we have a sense of how God saw this situation through his own heart and his own eyes. I'll put this on the screen for you. It's actually found in Genesis chapter 49. As Jacob is speaking over his sons, he says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join their assembly, for they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger so fierce and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. Now, notice on the very last line, he says, I will scatter them in Jacob. I will disperse them in Israel. Jacob is a man who's about to curl up, pull up his feet in bed and die. So obviously Jacob is not the one speaking here. He is speaking for the Lord. This is God speaking about the sons. And this is God addressing the issue of violence, which takes place in the chapter that we're studying here. And what does God say to them? I'm going to scatter them. And this is the time when Jacob has been speaking blessings over his sons, but he does not speak any such blessing over these two boys because of what they've done. Chapter 35. And then God said to Jacob, go up to Bethel and settle there and build an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. Stop there if you would please just for a moment. God is now calling Jacob to move his family and all of his belongings to Bethel, which was the place, you'll remember, where God appeared to Jacob when he was running for his life from his brother Esau, 20, probably 30 now years earlier. And what's interesting about this is that Bethel is only about 15 miles from Shechem. But it's also about 1,000 feet higher in elevation. So it's from Shechem, it's about straight up to go to Bethel. And apparently Jacob hadn't been there in all the time that he'd been back in the land. We're kind of assuming that. But it says, so Jacob said to his household in verse 2, and to all who were with him, get rid of the foreign gods you have with you and purify yourselves and change your clothes. Then come, let us go to Bethel, where I will build an altar to God who answered me in the day of my distress and who has been with me wherever I have gone. And so they gave Jacob all the foreign gods they had and the rings in their ears, and Jacob buried them under the oak at Shechem. Stop there for a moment. You kind of read that and you go, what's up with this? Aren't these godly people? Where are these foreign gods coming from? Shechem. Probably 10 years of living near this pagan city had far more of an influence. And do you remember after the boys went and slaughtered all the men, what did they do? They took the women and all their belongings. Well, guess what came with them? I mean, these people are pagans. All their idolatry came along with them. And the people, Jacob's own family, began to embrace some of this stuff. These little trinkets and lucky charms and idols and things that went along with paganism. And they just kind of embrace this stuff over a period of time. And then before God calls Jacob and his family to go up to Bethel and to meet with the Lord there, he says, you need to go and confront your family. There's stuff going on you may not even be aware of, but I know it's going on. So go and talk to your family. Tell them to get rid of all their foreign gods. So Jacob does. And he pulls off all the rings and all the little trinkets and whatever all else, and he buries them under the oak there at Shechem. And it says that they set out then in verse 5, and the terror of God fell upon the towns all around them, so no one pursued them. You know what that is? That's grace. In fact, God's grace has been upon Israel during this whole time, but do you remember what Jacob said when he confronted his sons with their crime in Shechem? He said, listen, the people around here are going to hear about this, and they're going to come, and they're going to amass an army, and they're going to figure you guys are troublemakers, and then when that happens, we're dead. Because there's way more people in the land than we can possibly fight. And God knew that too. And so as they begin to move now toward Bethel, that 15-mile trip, in order to protect them from the people coming out and pursuing them, God puts a fear into the hearts of those townspeople in whichever communities lie between them and Bethel so that none of them come and pursue. Because they were worthy? No. Because of grace. Because of God's grace. In fact, this whole Shechem situation, you know, think about what would have happened if they would have let's say Shechem didn't violate Dinah, and they just came and he just wanted to marry her, and they came out and they said, "Hey, can my son marry your daughter? You know, he thinks she's pretty hot, and so he'd like to marry her and stuff. So you guys can marry our girls, and we'll just kind of be a big family." You know what that's, you know, he's talking about integrating what is now this early stage of the nation of Israel into this pagan nation. Well, if that integration took place, if that assimilation took place, there would be no Jewish people. They would literally be absorbed into this Canaanite people, and they would be gone. So there was an element of protection that had to take place, you know. And God is even protecting their national identity here as they're traveling, lest they be wiped out. And their name is just obliterated, and all of God's promises come to nothing, which of course can't happen. God literally goes before them with this holy fear, this holy terror. And it says in verse 6 that Jacob and all the people with him came to Luz, and that's what it was named before. He called it Bethel in the land of Canaan. And there he built an altar, and he called the place El Bethel, which means God of Bethel, because it was there that God revealed himself to him when he was fleeing from his brother. He had previously called it Bethel, that which means the house of God, and now he calls it the God of the house of God. And as kind of an aside note, we're told in verse 8 that Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried under the oak below Bethel, so it was named Elon Bechuth, which means oak of weeping. Now, notice that this is Rebekah's nurse. Rebekah is Jacob's mother. Remember, we're not talking about Rachel here. Don't get them mixed up, who is his wife. This is Rebekah, his mother's nurse. How she got in with their party, we don't know. We're not told. But she's there, and she passes away during that time. She's obviously a very old woman by this time, if she was a nurse to Jacob's mother. And so it says that after Jacob returned from Padan Aram, God appeared to him again and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob, but you will no longer be called Jacob. Your name will be Israel." So he named him Israel. And of course, that had happened 10 years or so previous when he wrestled with him in chapter 32. Then God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and increase in number. A nation and a community of nations will come from you, and kings will come from your body. The land I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I also give to you. And I will give this land to your descendants after you. And then God went up from him at the place where he had talked with him. Jacob set up a stone pillar at the place where God had talked with him, and he poured out a drink offering on it. He also poured oil on it, same thing he had done about 30 years before. And Jacob called the place where God had talked with him Bethel, the house of God. And then they moved from Bethel. And while they were still some distance from Ephrath, which is an older, ancient name for the city of Bethlehem, or I should say the village, Rachel began to give birth and had great difficulty. And as she was having great difficulty in childbirth, the midwife said to her, "Don't be afraid, for you have another son." And as she breathed her last, for she was dying, she named her son Benoni, which means son of my trouble. But his father named him Benjamin, meaning son of my right hand. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Over her tomb, Jacob set up a pillar. And to this day, that pillar marks Rachel's tomb. Israel moved on again and pitched his tent beyond Migdal Eder, which is the tower, means the Tower of Eder. And while Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah, and Israel heard of it. Let me stop there for just a moment. This was more than just another stupid act by a young man. Reuben was the oldest of Jacob's sons, and as the oldest, he stood in line to receive the inheritance, the greatest inheritance rights. It was a pagan a sort of a tradition. And this, again, speaks of how his family had been influenced by paganism. But it was a pagan sort of a thing for a man, before he took over his father's legacy, to take over his father's harem, if you will. It was a sign of the son coming to strength and taking over all that his father once ruled over and possessed. And it was a pagan thing. And again, as I said before, it shows that Jacob's children had been influenced by pagan thought processes and so forth. But Reuben was both premature and self-willed in this. And as a result, he actually lost his inheritance. And from this point forth, God is going to speak of Reuben in that sense as the man who presumptuously and sinfully stepped against his father. And we are told in the latter part of verse 22, these four words, it simply says Jacob had 12 sons. And in the following verses, they're simply listed for us there. The sons of Leah, once again. Reuben, the firstborn of Jacob, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. And of course, Dinah was also born to Leah. It says in verse 24 that the sons of Rachel are Joseph and Benjamin, the sons of Rachel's maidservant Bilhah, Dan, and Naphtali, the sons of Leah's maidservant Zilpah, Gad, and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. And Jacob came home to his father Isaac in Mamre near Kiriath Arba, and we're told that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had stayed. And we're told that Isaac lived 180 years. That is amazing that he lived that long. But you'll remember that he was already blind at the time when Jacob left home. He'd already lost his sight due to his advanced age and how much else he had been incapacitated. We're not specifically told. But we're told in verse 29 that he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. And it appears, if you're thinking of timelines, and the Bible is kind of interesting how it does this, but if you're thinking in terms of timelines, it appears that the death of Isaac took place some, 30 years after Jacob made his way, 25 to 30 years after he made his way back to his homeland, which, interestingly enough, means that Isaac died after Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt. So that event probably already took place by this, but we're not given that information yet in chronological, in true chronological order, because the narrative wants to make the point about Isaac's death here before going on with some events that happened before that. And so that's the way the writer chose to kind of place this first narrative event. But I think it's interesting that it says that Isaac, in verse 29, breathed his last and was gathered to his people, old and full of years. And you might think, wow, 180, that's old and full of years. That's, yeah. But you know what's interesting about that statement, that phrase, old and full of years? Same thing is said of David, who died at 70. 70. And by today's standards, we don't, you know, consider that, you know, super old at all. And yet, it says of David, he was old and full of years. Isn't that interesting? So that whole concept of being full of years really isn't a numerical statement. It's probably more of a qualitative statement, speaking of how the man lived, you know? And I think that you could probably live, well, if you could live to be 180 today, I think there's a possibility you could die not being full of years. Because you sat around and did very little, you know, in terms of living life, you know. So living life is far more, at least as the Bible sees it, I think it shows it as more of a qualitative sort of a statement than it does in dealing with quantity alone.